This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture. I'm PJ Thumb and I'm a historian from the University of Oxford, and this is the history of Singapore. Previously on the history of Singapore. Throughout 1956, the left-wing anti-colonial movement had grown into a coherent multi-ethnic, multi-linguistic movement, the Anti-Yellow Cultural Council, that threatened the very foundation, the moral right to British rule in Singapore. In July 1956, a worried colonial secretary, Alan Lennox Boyd, met with Singapore Chief Minister Lim Yew Hock in London. Lennox Boyd made it very clear to Lim Yew Hock that if he wanted Singapore to receive self-government, then one of the key components of the left-wing anti-colonial movement, the Singapore Chinese Middle School Students' Union, had to be crushed. Meanwhile, Lim Yew Hock and PAP Secretary General Lee Kuan Yew were secretly colluding on the destruction of the PAP left-wing. But both men knew this was a temporary alliance of convenience. The trick was to ensure the destruction of the PAP left-wing while evading blame, or better yet, ensuring that the other man took the blame. How would they do it? Who would succeed? Stay tuned for an explosive episode of The History of Singapore. Hello and welcome to The History of Singapore, Episode 30, Pa Mata. In August and September 1956, Singapore's Council of Ministers met to decide how to deal with the Anti-Yellow Cultural Council. As mentioned last week, Special Branch Director Alan Blades advised the arrest of anyone who acted like a communist. In other words, anyone who opposed the government. Likewise, in a series of memoranda, Chief Secretary William Good emphasized the potential threat of the Anti-Yellow Cultural Council and the society supporting it by engaging in lawful anti-colonial activity, expanding their membership, building a multi-ethnic coalition, and opposing government policy. These left-wing organizations were in alignment with the MCP's goals, he argued. So the fact that they were not actually aligned with the MCP itself was irrelevant. The lack of evidence of communist activity or even communist belief was irrelevant. The principle of innocent until proven guilty was irrelevant. All that mattered was getting rid of people who disagreed with the government. But in his memoranda, he also gives the game away by writing that the real subversive threat was their, quote, completely un-Malayan character, unquote. The associations had become too successful at organizing resistance to government policy. Now, by challenging the moral authority of the colonial government, they had possibly found an issue to unite the anti-colonial movement and undermine the entire basis of British decolonization policy in Singapore. They were no longer challenging British policy. The days of requesting and appealing for change were over. Now the anti-colonial movement was challenging the British moral authority to rule. They were challenging the British version of post-colonial identity and the British right to impose that vision on Singapore. Malayan identity was for Malayans to decide, not the British. And the Malayans were going to take their rights, were going to rip it from the hands of the British. And the British could not permit that. They could not stand against a coherent, multi-ethnic, multi-linguistic Singapore-wide movement. It would undermine their entire decolonization scheme, and so it had to be crushed before it got too far. And so the Council of Ministers met at 10 a.m. on Monday, 17 September 1956, to consider Blades and Good's memoranda and to decide upon a strategy for crushing the left. An operations committee consisting of Lim Yew Hock, Chief Secretary William Good, and Chew Swee Kee was appointed to decide on the timing of the actions. The council approved the dissolution of three key Anti-Yellow Cultural Council members' associations, the Singapore Women's Federation, the Chinese Gong Musical Society, and the Singapore Chinese Middle School Students' Union. And they decided on the banishment of six of their officials to China. Attorney General C.H. Butterfield, interestingly enough, dissented on 4 of the 6 banishments. The state's top lawyer felt that there was insufficient evidence from a legal perspective, but he was overruled by the politicians and the officials. So the operations committee decided on a plan to try and provoke anger, to try and get people to rise up in anger, which would then allow them to argue that the government was responding to disturbances rather than provoking them, and thus legitimating, excusing the use of violent force. So they would start with only the dissolution of the Singapore Women's Federation and the Chinese Gong Musical Society on 18th and 19th September. Lim would then announce that the dissolutions and banishments were due to activities, quote, against the public interest, unquote, but carefully would add that the actions were not evidence of MCP infiltration. He would deny the targeting of any particular association, but he would say the arrests were to reduce obstacles to self-government. Ultimately, independence would be the excuse used to justify the arrests and dissolutions. And then, when the Singapore Chinese Middle School Students Union protested, its protest would be then used to justify its dissolution and the detention of its leaders. Naturally, it goes without saying that this underhanded strategy would never have been approved while David Marshall was in charge. At the same time, William Good and Alan Blades were not sure if it would work. They predicted that as the, quote, main policy of the MCP is to avoid an open clash and to concentrate on peaceful penetration, unquote. They felt that the Singapore Factory Shop Workers Union would probably react cautiously, that other middle road unions would probably sit on the fence, that the Nanyang University students would probably be hostile but would be content with speeches and protest meetings. So they wouldn't be anywhere near violent enough to justify a violent response. The PAP, of course, would be hostile, but in accordance with the British policy to drive a wedge between the left and right wings of the PAP, they felt that strong action by the government now might assist the non-communist wing of the PAP to regain control. And finally, they believed that UMNO, Singapore MCA, and the Singapore Trade Union Congress would likely support the action. But the British officials were wrong. The banishments and the dissolutions were carried out, and in response, the people of Singapore erupted in anger. The depth of public anger was a massive surprise. All the affected associations issued protests demanding the prompt release of the detainees or trial in open court, and they were joined by a wide range of other unions, welfare organizations, civil society associations, including Malay and Indian organizations, and organizations in the Federation of Malaya, and the Chinese press, and the Utusan Melayu, who all condemned the arbitrary arrests and demanded public trials. There was widespread public confusion and anger and disbelief. According to the government's own official reports, communist activity had fallen to new lows, while secret society activity and other crime had been steadily rising. Yet, the former was being targeted, while the latter ignored. And equally, after 14 months under David Marshall, expectations had shifted. Marshall had resisted the use of detention without trial, had only reluctantly endorsed it in response to specific incidents, not preemptively, and had worked to ensure it was carried out fairly and transparently. Coincidentally, or perhaps not, Singapore had been quiet and peaceful in 1956. But Singaporeans weren't stupid. This action, out of the blue, clearly targeted the largest and most influential anti-colonial associations. It was clear to people that the government was choosing to get rid of the associations to crush their goal of democratic self-determination. It was widely believed that Alan Lennox Boyd had made internal self-government conditional on the government demonstrating that it had complete control of Singapore's internal security. The Joint Working Committee of the trade unions put out a statement lamenting the need for, quote-unquote, colonial trickery. Others speculated that it was actually Lim Yew Hock seeking to remove opposition activists and politicians and organizations from his path. And in the Legislative Assembly, Assemblyman Goh Chiu Chua accused him of both, saying, quote, pleasing the colonial office and smashing the anti-colonial forces are the same thing. Making Singapore safe for the Labour Front and making Singapore safe for the British government, unquote. The Nanyang Shangbao reminded its readers of the gulf between the colonial government and colonial society in terms of its philosophy and values. It wrote, quote, "Ideological movements are regarded by society as political campaigning, but by the government as political subversion," unquote. On 23rd September, at the second anniversary celebration of the Singapore Factory Shop Workers Union, Lim Chin Siong argued that arbitrary arrests would actually jeopardize independence by demonstrating that Singapore was not mature enough for democracy. He announced a one-hour protest strike the following day. But mindful of the great public anger, he also urged calm, saying, quote, "We can only unite together, remain calm, and not be impulsive, so that the public may understand that we are reasonable and will agree with us. We believe that the people are strong and that there are various ways and means to resolve this situation. We must be brave and calm with no emotion," unquote. He understood that further violence, further anger, could provoke a disproportionate government response. On 24th September, 35,000 people struck, and at a further meeting on 25th September, the Singapore Factory Shop Workers Union resolved to observe a 15-minute silence every day at 8 a.m. in continued protest. Protest rallies had also erupted at all the Chinese middle schools following the dissolution of the Singapore Chinese Middle School Students' Union. The Students' Union Committee appealed for calm and released a statement saying they had handed the matter to their lawyers, Lee Kuan Yew and Tan Wee Tiong, to handle. In the meantime, students were urged to carry on as normal. Student Union President Sun Lo Boon emphasized that the unions had been very careful to adhere to the law in its activities and would take all proper steps in seeking its reinstatement. But as part of its pre-arranged response, the government banned all assemblies in schools. The remaining student union leaders formed a new committee. It released a statement asking the government to put the arrested on trial. They pointed out that the union had been careful not to take part in political activities or industrial disputes, as per their constitution. Students held separate meetings at all the Chinese middle schools. School authorities reminded them that gatherings in schools had been banned by the government, but the students defended the freedom of association. The meetings passed resolutions expressing support for the Singapore Chinese Middle School Students' Union. They also urged fellow students to remain calm, continue to attend classes, not to camp in schools, and above all, to adhere to legal and peaceful means of protest. On 28 September, an anti-yellow cultural council delegation, led by Lim Chin Siong, called on Chief Minister Lim Yew Hock. Lim Chin Siong asked the Chief Minister to release the arrested or put them on trial, and Lim Yew Hock refused. Lim Chin Siong then challenged him to the court of public opinion. A referendum, or a by-election in the Chief Minister's constituency of Havelock. The Chief Minister again refused. The meeting broke up with both sides mutually antagonized. A civil rights convention was organized and held its inaugural meeting at the Hokkien Association on 28 September. Governor Black initially dismissed the news as a meeting of, quote, "the old gang under a new hat," unquote. But to his surprise, over 700 people representing 106 organizations with a combined membership of 200,000 people attended. This included representatives from the left and from the right, from all the major linguistic and ethnic groups. Across the board, representing all of Singapore, resolutions were passed demanding justice. An 11-member committee was appointed to organize peaceful and constitutional protest. A signature campaign was announced. But the government ignored their demands. On 1st October, it arrested Sun Lo Boon. 2 days later, it arrested Singapore Factory Shop Workers Union Secretary and PAP Executive Committee Chia Ek Tien, and this further inflamed the situation. In the Legislative Assembly, Lee Kuan Yew moved the motion that, quote, "deplores the arbitrary manner of the government's action," unquote. But already you can see he was positioning himself carefully. His speech carefully focused on the abstract when he said, quote, "If we say that the fabric of a democratic society is one which allows the free play of ideas, which avoids revolution by violence because revolution by peaceful methods of persuasion is allowed, then, in the name of all the gods that we have in this country, give that free play a chance to work within the constitutional framework, unquote. Lim Chin Siong, in seconding the motion, was much more concrete, much more direct in his criticism. He pointed out that the government had provided no evidence for the arrests. Instead, the arrests were justified by vague phrases like, quote, in the best interest of the people, unquote, and, quote, activities incompatible with the peace and good order of the colony, unquote, whatever those phrases meant. But he inadvertently hit the nail on the head when he pointed out that the case against the detainees boiled down to the fact that the detainees were behaving in a way which the government believed was communist. He said, quote, according to our Minister for Education, the collective study groups among Chinese students are communists because the communists also have such study groups. By this logic, study group movements throughout the world must be communists. The Chinese communists eat rice. Our Minister for Education also eats rice, therefore he too must be a communist. Englishmen prefer their tea at 4 p.m. So Asians who drink their tea at 4 p.m. are therefore Englishmen. Americans drive about in American cars. Harry Lee also drives an American car, therefore Harry Lee is an American. Unquote. This was, Lim declared, a McCarthy's witch hunt to further the interests of London and Washington. And Lim again challenged Lim Yew Hock to an election or a referendum to prove his public support, or to hold a trial to prove the charges. He mocked Lim Yew Hock, saying, quote, I will guarantee this. Whatever the chief minister might say, he will not offer to prove his charges by democratic process in an open court, and because of this, what he says will possess no value at all, unquote. Faced with sustained protests and condemnation from all corners of Singapore society, the government realized they had miscalculated. In trying to disrupt the anti-yellow cultural council with a series of carefully timed and staggered arrests, their repressive actions had instead created the basis for genuine unity with the government as the common enemy. The staggered timing provided sustained momentum to build up the movement. The Council of Ministers, faced with the extremely broad Civil Rights Convention, realized they had crossed the line of no return. Or as Governor Black put it, quote, they have embarked upon this action and cannot go back, unquote. So either they bowed to public anger and released the detainees, or they doubled down and kept arresting and banishing people and dissolving organizations until no one was left to oppose them. What did they decide? Join us when we return. BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, and I'm PJ Thumb. If you've just joined us, welcome to this week's episode of The History of Singapore, Pa Mata. Welcome back. The Council of Ministers was faced with such public anger that they had two choices. Either they bowed to the public anger and released the detainees, or they doubled down and kept arresting and banishing people and dissolving organizations until no one was left to oppose them. At a council meeting on 8th October 1956, they resolved to broaden the scope of their action. And so this is the point where they drop any pretense of the national interests or anti-colonial solidarity or the common good. This was now all about survival. They were now in a contest of wills with the Civil Rights Convention. They had to break or be broken. So they enforced restrictions on public assembly to try to limit public protests. At a rally, PAP Organizing Secretary Ong Pang Boon declared, quote, this is no surprise to us, for all fascist regimes are afraid to let people know the truth, unquote. Ironic, of course, since the PAP itself would severely restrict public assembly after it got into power. Ong Pang Boon is still alive today, and no doubt he would call the current PAP government a fascist regime as well. Rally speeches repeatedly pointed out that the government had no evidence, based the arrest entirely on speculation, and deplored the use of arbitrary detention without trial. In the meantime, the government was busy. More arrests, more detentions, more banishment. Students were arrested in their home search. Schools were forced to dismiss over 140 students and some teachers. New regulations were passed, restricting the right of schools to accept students, and Chinese school management were pressured to close the schools. The management committees of Zhongzheng and Chinese High both suddenly found a backbone and refused to comply. Yeo Chan Boon, Chinese High Management Committee chairman, declared that if the government wanted the schools closed, it should do so itself and bear the consequences itself. Undaunted, the government did just that. It closed both schools on 12 October and opened temporary replacement schools. Over 3,000 students gathered at Zhongzheng and over 4,000 students and 1,000 parents at Chinese High. They condemned the government action and resolved to stay to protest. If the government wanted to destroy Chinese education and keep them in a colonized mentality, they would hold their own classes and continue their own education. The students camped at Chinese High, maintaining regular classes, supported by their parents and other organizations. And it's important to remember that the students had the support of their parents. At a meeting of the Students' Parents Association on 14 October, many parents expressed disbelief and anger at the government's actions. The same day, 40 cultural associations also met to support the students, and an on-the-spot fund drive raised $2,871.50 to help student expenses. Parents ignored the orders of Minister for Education Chu Shui-kee not to send food into schools. In the first 5 days of the students' occupation of the schools, a total of $10,129.82 was donated by the public, as well as over a metric ton of food and provisions. The students also received support from the International Students' Confederation. Malay representatives of the Pan-Malayan Students' Federation visited and were delighted to see Malay being taught as a compulsory class. The Chinese press contrasted the order and discipline of the student-run schools with reports of ill discipline and secret society infiltration at the government-run English schools. Student representatives sought to meet the chief minister, but he replied he could not guarantee their safety. The government turned its attention to the associations which were most active in supporting the students. On 23rd and 24th October, the government dissolved the Graduates of 1953 Arts Association, the Zhongzheng Alumni Association, the Chinese Schools Parents Association, the Chinese Primary Schools Teachers Association, then detained a further round of activists. Singapore was heaving with anger and frustration. Both sides were becoming more polarized. A clash was coming. The PAP's protest rallies continued on the 16th and 17th and the 24th and 25th October. The Singapore's Farmers Association held 8 rallies. The Civil Rights Convention had a massive rally in Yio Chu Kang on 23rd October. On 21st October, the first day of the Civil Rights Convention's signature campaign, just on the first day alone, over 30,000 signatures were collected. That same day, in a secret telegram to London, Governor Black noted that public opinion had turned decisively against the government. Indeed, Chinese High and Zhongzheng were simply carrying on in spite of government orders to shut down. They had become symbols of government irrelevance. They had to be crushed or the government would look impotent. The council met and decided to disperse the students by force. Lim Yew Hock announced this, along with yet more dissolutions and detentions, and warned parents to remove their children from the two schools by 8 p.m. on 25th October. In response, crowds gathered outside the schools. The PAP held a rally on 25th October at Beauty World at 7 p.m, 2 miles down Bukit Timah Road from Chinese High. After the conclusion, many of the rally attendees walked down Bukit Timah Road and joined the crowds, further swelling them. The same evening, the Civil Rights Convention Committee held a meeting at the Singapore Factory Shop Workers Union headquarters in Middle Road. Fong Swee Swan was worried that there would be bloodshed when the police invaded the schools, and he said, "We have to do something. Innocent students will be hurt if the government did not back down. Furthermore, once the police came for the students, the trade unions would be next. But what could they do? Their options were limited. They really had only one weapon, the general strike, and so they agreed a one-day strike the next day, with another meeting afterward to review the situation. But it was too late. At 8 p.m, the police surrounded both schools. According to Lee Kuan Yew, who was an eyewitness, quote, "The police made no attempt to disperse the crowd. People were not asked to break up and move along. Why the police chose to do nothing until it got out of hand is a question which only those who planned the Labour Front strategy can answer," unquote. Sometime that night, fighting broke out outside Chinese High, which spread across the city throughout the night. After the riots of 1955, the military and police had developed a plan for dealing with riots. It was called Operation Photo. It was quickly launched and the riots were crushed. At daybreak the next morning, the police launched tear gas into the schools. At Zhongzheng, parents linked arms to form a circle to protect their children, but they broke up under the tear gas. The students fled with the police in pursuit. Rioting erupted again. Spurred by general anger, it spread all over the island. 13 people were killed. A curfew was declared. At the same time, the Middle Road unions launched their pre-arranged strike. Workers assembled at Yeo Hup Sing, Hume Industries and Nanyang Shoe Factories to prepare to march on the Legislative Assembly. The union management committees were explicitly told to maintain order amongst their workers and to disperse if met by the police. They would then reform again and continue to march. If the police arrested any marchers, other workers were to peacefully demand the release of their colleagues. If this did not happen, then they were to insist that they were to be arrested too and would peacefully cooperate. When workers assembled at Yeo Hup Sing factory, however, they became involved in a clash with the police. Instead of waiting for the scheduled start time, they started to march by themselves. They then clashed again with the police at Beauty World. The other marchers also met with police roadblocks and failed. The committees had lost control of the workers and the police successfully dispersed them. In the confusion, many workers returned to the Singapore and Factory Shop Workers Union premises to wait for further instructions. After a 7 p.m. meeting, workers were told to go home. But the curfew was in effect. They could not leave. So many chose to stay and sleep on the premises. Now, the previous night, William Good, using the Criminal Law Temporary Provisions Ordinance, had declared any gathering of 10 or more people to be illegal. The police were tipped off that large gatherings were in place at the various Singapore Factory Shop Workers Union offices. The police raided the four offices and found sleeping workers and arrested a total of 219 people, including Lim Chin Siong and Fong Sui Suan. Virtually the entire leadership of the Singapore Factory Shop Workers Union and the Singapore Bus Workers Union were arrested. The council subsequently dissolved the Singapore Farmers Association and the Singapore Wooden House Dwellers Association on 1st November. On a meeting in 10th November, the Council of Ministers approved the detention of Lim Chin Siong and agreed that if sufficient evidence could be found, he had to be prosecuted. They also agreed to the detentions of a further 12 Singapore and Factory Shop Workers Union leaders, including Fong Sui Suan, Chan Chiao Tho, James Puthucheary, Devan Nair, and S. Woodhull. A further 163 people were preemptively detained, with their cases to be examined afterwards to determine if there were grounds for their detention. Lim Yew Hock and William Good had finally broken the momentum of the independent Chinese organizations. But public faith in the government was destroyed, and unable to find a basis to prosecute Lim Chin Siong, the government justified his detention by claiming he had inflamed the crowds at the 25th October rally, setting off the riot. In the Legislative Assembly, Chew Swee Kee stated, quote, "It is significant to note that the member for Bukit Timah at that meeting said that instead of shouting Merdeka, the people should now shout Pamata, which means beat the police. Is there any doubt whatsoever as to who sparked off the riots?" But this was a lie. Lim had sought to calm the crowds and urged peaceful action. At the rally, he had used humor to diffuse tension. The police transcript of his speech reads, quote, "With regards to police, they are all wage earners and they are all here to attend this meeting to oppose Lim Yew Hock. We gladly welcome them, and the more of them that attend will make us even stronger. a lot of people don't want to shout Merdeka. They want to shout Pa Mata. This is wrong. We want to ask them to cooperate with us because they are also wage earners, and so that in the time of crisis, they will take their guns and run away. And this drew laughter. But the greatest betrayal belonged to Lee Kuan Yew. He had been present at Lim's speech at Beauty World. He had been sitting on the platform when Lee spoke. And now he was sitting in the Legislative Assembly as Chew Swee Kee made his fraudulent accusation. And in response to Chew's lies, Lee Kuan Yew said nothing. Instead, he implicitly supported the government's allegations of communist penetration of the anti-colonial movement by saying, quote, "I have said this before and I say this now. There are three forces in this country: British imperialism, communism, and Malayan nationalism," unquote. But he insisted that the battle had to be against imperialism first, then communism second. He continued, quote, "To fight the communists, one must understand how they think. One must understand what they are after. If, in fact, my colleague, the member for Bukit Timah, Lim Chin Siong, was a communist, then I would say I would agree 75% with him. But I do not agree even 25% with members on the other side of the house," unquote. And with these words, Lee Kuan Yew stabbed the knife into the back of his colleagues, his allies, the PAP left. His message to the British was clear. He was saying that, yes, my colleagues, the PAP left wing, are communists and I am working with them, yes. Why? Because I would rather support communists than colonialists. So I will fight you, the British imperialists. But the moment colonialism ends, I will fight the communists. Therefore, if you don't want me to fight you, if you want me to take care of the communists, you should hand me all the power of government and leave and let me take care of the communists. Lee's implicit admission that his allies were communists further infuriated the PAP left. To the satisfaction of Lim Yew Hock and Governor Black, it widened the gap within the PAP between left and right. It fell to David Marshall and Lim Chir King to represent the left, to speak up for the detainees. Marshall reminded the assembly of the discrimination faced by the Chinese, and he said, quote, "When you say to me, sir, be loyal to Singapore, I understand that means loyalty to the democratic way of life, constitutional progress, Commonwealth relationship. When you say to a Chinese-speaking Chinese, be loyal to Singapore, he thinks of the decades of discrimination and exploitation. He wants to change this, and so do I. The people of Singapore should discard this idea of disloyal Chinese." In his response, Lim Yew Hock carefully danced around the fact that the raids of the various Singapore factory shop workers' union officers had turned up no evidence of any communist connection. Lim avoided any mention of the MCP in connection with the Singapore and factory shop workers' union. Instead, he insisted that the union itself was dedicated to the violent overthrow of the government, and this despite all the pronouncements, all the announcements by the union to avoid violence, to keep to legal and peaceful means of protest. The Singapore Factories and Shop Workers Union was subsequently banned on February 1957. And so the anti-colonial movement was broken, its leaders detained, its main organizations dissolved. Lim Yew Hock had delivered on Lennox Boyd's demands, and he triumphantly announced that Lennox Boyd had agreed to fresh talks. But Lim Yew Hock and Lee Kuan Yew's anti-colonial credentials had also been tainted by their actions. Lim had been revealed to be a running dog of the British. Lee Kuan Yew had been shown to be willing to betray his colleagues for his own benefit. A backlash was coming. And so when they went to London in March 1957 for new talks, they would also aim to fix the constitutional agreement to ensure that their rivals, David Marshall and the PAP left wing, would not be able to win. Join us next week when I detail how this was achieved. As always, if you have any questions, comments or feedback, please email me at thehistoryofsingapore@gmail.com or visit my webpage at thehistoryofsingapore.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit Patreon, patreon.com/pjthumb. Thank you very much and see you next week. This has been The History of Singapore, BFM 89.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.